This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis, and today we go a little farther than Southern California. We're taking you to Mars. Well, as close as you can get to Mars from here on planet Earth. We're at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and you're listening to the wind on Mars. The engineers say that wind blows 10 to 15 miles per hour from northwest to southeast. And scientists at JPL recorded that wind. They're the ones leading Mars missions, like the ones with the Spirit and Opportunity rovers that, you know, roved across the red planet. The newest Mars spacecraft is the InSight lander, which touched down on November 26th. NASA sent InSight to drill into the planet and study what's going on inside, to record the temperature, for example, and the pressure and vibrations. Every move InSight makes on Mars is first tested at JPL, in a building that from the outside just looks like an ordinary warehouse.
Okay, I'll go through some of the rules as soon as I got everybody in here.
Hi, come on in.
The engineer who leads those tests is Marlene Martinez Sundgaard. Now, Marlene is not what you might think of as a typical NASA engineer.
I remember my first field was beans, and then I worked in sugar beets, and then we did potatoes.
She's the daughter of migrant workers from Mexico.
Starting at the age of 13, for the next 3 summers, I would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. We had to be in the field by 5 o'clock, and we would just start working, and we'd be working for the next, 9 or 10 hours.
From the potato fields to JPL, Kirsten Zilm has Marlene's story.
Now you're going to see where all the really good toys are.
The real InSight lander is a robot up on Mars. Down here, Marlene works with an exact replica. It's about 5 feet tall, the same size as she is. The lander stands on 3 stilts. Its big dome is covered in gold foil. It has solar panels and a long arm with a claw on the end. Nearby are a seismometer and the so-called mole, built to hammer deep into the Martian surface.
This is where all the good stuff happens, and we actually get to use our hands and do things that we're going to do on Mars and actually see how they're going to come out as close as we can replicate the systems.
Marlene is a 35-year-old engineer. Her dark hair falls over the white lab coat, which almost reaches her ankles. She's wearing jeans and white sneakers underneath. To simulate the red Mars surface, Marlene moves gray gravel in the sandbox. She is not surrounded by the vastness of space, but by measuring instruments, caution tape, cameras, and lights.
I would love to go to Mars. I know it sounds crazy, but ever since I was a kid, I've just always wanted to go to space. I've always wanted to look back onto the Earth. I've wanted to just go and explore.
Marlene's dream of space exploration started when her father showed her and her 4 siblings the stars from their backyard. Then, at 5 years old, she learned a song about space in kindergarten.
I sang a song on Mother's Day, and it was a song called Mission Control. And I remember I had this like little solo part, and the words were, "I may be small, but I'm growing. Watch one day, and you'll see space is wide open and waiting for me."
Maybe I'm small, but I'm growing. Watching one day, you will see. Space is wide open and waiting for me.
Marlene did not have any role models. Her parents and grandparents were migrant workers from Mexico. Each year, they came to Washington State to work in the fields for 9 months. Then, in the winter months, the family moved back to Mexico. The kids left the American school system and went to school in Mexico for those few months each year. Marlene spoke enough Spanish to talk with her grandparents, friends, and neighbors. She did not know enough words to understand cell division, gravity, and other high school subjects.
I would just really quickly write down as fast as I could what the teacher was saying, and then I would get home and I would have my mom or dad translate it for me and tell me what was the teacher writing on the board. I have no idea what this all means. It was a little bit confusing, and it was really difficult.
Another thing made school difficult. Marlene's mouth twitched. Her eyes winked. She repeated whole sentences. It took her years to understand that her tics are part of a neurological disorder she has, Tourette syndrome. Today, Martina Sundgaard is a member of the board of directors for a Tourette syndrome camping organization. Every summer, she shares her story with kids who come to camp.
I try to inspire them to, you know, follow their dreams. Just because you have Tourette syndrome, you might have a few more obstacles to overcome, but it doesn't mean you can't do it. You can still reach for your dreams and try to achieve everything that you think is possible.
Marlene took her first step toward achieving her dream of becoming an astronaut at age 13, when she won a space essay contest. The prize? 1 week of space camp in Alabama.
They put us in like a gravity simulator that some of the astronauts trained in. And then I sat in what they called the 6DF chair, 6 degrees of freedom chair, and it would hover off the floor just a little bit. So I was floating. And so that was just so much fun.
From hovering in an astronaut suit in space camp, Marlene went straight back to picking beans.
That was also the beginning of just me saying, okay, I'm definitely not going to be staying in the field. I'm definitely going to space. What do I need to do to get there?
She knew that first of all, she needed good grades in school and got those. Then she got internships in space research. Then a full scholarship to study aerospace engineering at the University of Washington. Marlene Martinez Sundgaard understands that she now is a role model for girls and young women. It motivates her to inspire them, especially daughters of immigrants.
When I started college, I was behind everybody else. So I had to play catch up just to get the grades I needed to land a really good job and get really good internships and stuff like that. So that's pretty much, I think, the battle that a lot of students from Hispanic communities are trying to fight right now, is just have people in their lives convince them that they can get a degree in engineering and a degree in medical science or a degree in physics, just to give them the confidence to say, hey, go for it. You can do it. You just need to apply yourself and study hard, and you can be anything you want. And I think that's what a lot of people are missing.
Marlene has not given up her dream of going to Mars. 3 times she applied for the NASA astronaut program. The rejection letters are framed in her house. They are reminders of where she still wants to go. Meanwhile, in Pasadena's Jet Propulsion Laboratory Mars testbed, she came very close to feeling as if she really was on the red planet. It happened when she and her team adjusted gravel in the sandbox after InSight sent pictures of the landing site down to Earth.
It was the first time that I put on the HoloLens, and instead of seeing test bed in front of me like I was used to, I saw red Mars in front of me. And I just thought, oh my God, this is Mars. And you could feel like you're walking on it. Your mind just starts to play tricks on you.
Marlene stayed focused on the task ahead, which was to simulate the Mars surface as carefully and as precisely as she could. Only on the way home, she let her feelings go.
In my car, I just started sobbing because I just couldn't believe what I had done that day. But it was just, it was amazing. I mean, that was as close as I've been to walking on Mars, and it was pretty cool.
Marlene Martinez Sundgaard has a 2-year-old son. Her husband also is a NASA engineer, but one with no dream to go to space. Still, she will apply for the astronaut program again next year. And she keeps studying so that when the first manned spacecraft heads to Mars, Marlene will be the best woman for the job in space. For KCRW, I'm Kerstin Sim.
I want to study the planets. I want to study the stars. I want to go up to Venus or Mars. So mission control, do you read me? I really take too much room. Mission control, do you need me on the next trip to the moon?
Well, coming up, another city in greater LA passed some new rent control laws, what they do and don't do in a place where housing costs are skyrocketing. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, the past 24 hours have been instrumental to getting more affordable housing in some places. In New York State, Democrats approved a deal to strengthen rent laws and tenant protections, showing up their West Coast compatriots who have yet to make any housing or rent control headway in the California legislature. Closer to home, the Inglewood City Council passed its own rent control ordinance last night, and it came after years of activism by local residents, a passel of whom showed up yesterday at City Hall.
So are you ready?
Yeah.
I'm ready. Are you ready?
Yeah.
I'm ready. Are you ready?
Yeah.
All right, let's get ready to go upstairs.
All right, folks, KCRW's Anna Scott was there, and she joins us right now. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
So what is this new law in Inglewood do?
Well, it's a pretty big change because before this, Inglewood didn't have any form of rent control. So that means rent increases were unlimited. There really weren't any eviction protections. And more than 60% of the residents of the city are renters. So now this applies to buildings with more than four units, so apartment buildings, built before 1995. So it's not every single building in the city, but a lot of them. And it caps rent increases at 5% a year, or in some cases, 8% a year.
All right, talk a little bit about that, because there's this, there obviously we've got two different numbers here. And I saw a couple of different headlines this morning. I know Curbed LA said that the rent increases were capped at 5%, but the Daily Breeze said 8%.
I know, and it's confusing, but it's 5%, except in some cases where landlords have kept the rents quite low for many years, and they have a formula that defines low. It's 80% of the city's median rent. So for those landlords, they can do 8% a year until they catch up to market rate. I know that's confusing. And at this point, I don't know how many buildings will be in each category, but it's a maximum of 8%.
And that's for buildings built before 1995.
Right.
Inglewood is on a bit of a growth spurt right now. We've got a multi-billion dollar stadium going up for the Rams and the Chargers right there. So a lot of new apartment buildings are coming online. Whatever the number is, whether it be 5% or 8%, I imagine people who don't make a whole lot of money, that's a lot of money regardless.
Yeah, that is still a significant hike, even though this is a victory for tenants' rights advocates. That's still a significant increase. In the city of Los Angeles, for rent-controlled buildings, they can only raise rents 4% a year. For many years, it was 3%. Now it's 4%. So that's a pretty big hike. This was kind of a compromise. Most of the people who showed up at yesterday's City Hall hearing were in favor of these new protections, but there were also a small number of landlords who showed up. Some of them who had been in the community for many years said they've invested in the city for a long time and shouldn't be hamstrung in terms of what they can now charge. So this was a compromise of sorts.
A compromise, and a lot of folks have been following this issue. I mean, give us the backstory, Anna, on how this all began.
Well, with this law in particular, it was really activism on the part of people that live in Inglewood. You know, 2 years ago, the mayor of Inglewood, James Butts, told me to enact rent control, quote, we would strangle ourselves. That's, he said, to do it right now would totally economically hurt the city. Obviously, his ideas or his willingness changed, and that's largely because of a lot of activism on the part of groups like Uplift Inglewood or the Inglewood Tenants Union, who have been very active on this for the past few years.
And there's something to be said about being loud, right? And showing up at City Hall. And as we talked about, obviously the Rams Stadium going up, there's a lot of gentrification happening in Inglewood. People all over Greater LA are looking for less expensive places to live. Inglewood has been sort of one of those places. So yeah. What are we talking about specifically that's pushing up prices there?
Yeah, well, you just touched on a lot of it. The football stadium is a big deal. There's a lot of money going into that and a lot of new development around it. There's a few new metro stops coming to Inglewood. But the big thing is the geography of Los Angeles. In the past several years, we've seen lots of tech companies make their homes on the west side, bringing in many high-paid workers. There's not enough housing on the west side of LA. It's incredibly expensive. And in the past, I've interviewed an investor who was buying up apartment buildings in Inglewood, raising the rents. And he told me he basically just looked at a map and said, hey, okay, where are all those west side tech worker is going to go next, and looked at what was immediately east of places like Venice and Santa Monica, and he hit on Inglewood. And all of that is putting enormous pressure on longtime renters. One of them I spoke to at yesterday's meeting, her name is Tiffany Wallace, and she is with the Inglewood Tenants Union.
It's a pretty special city. I mean, it's my home. It's a city that's majority Black and brown people. Its median income is below the median income of Los Angeles. So it's like the city is being beautified, but it's not being beautified for us.
Wow.
Yeah, and she touched on another important thing there, which is that Inglewood is one of not very many largely Black communities in L.A. County. The Black population throughout L.A. County has shrunk a lot in recent years, and for a lot of people, it's important not to lose that. Dozens of people showed up yesterday to testify about how the rising cost of housing is changing life in the city. Another one of them is Victoria Preciado. She's a homeowner, actually, not a renter, but she's also a high school teacher in Inglewood.
I want to give you all a little insight into what my job has turned into the last couple years. Miss, my rent went up. I have to move schools. Miss, did you hear so-and-so spent the holidays in his car?
I mean, she had example after example of students coming to her with how their lives were being upended by incredibly high housing costs. So in short, there are a lot of longtime residents who have felt like changes are happening, new amenities, new investments are coming to the city, but not for them.
And the city made some decisions yesterday, though, that perhaps will help in the long run. We'll see.
Yes.
KCRW's Anna Scott. Anna, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, there's been a bit of a shift in the earth, in the Inland Empire. It's about as shaky as closing a file cabinet drawer, but what are those tiny earthquakes beneath Fontana and the Yurupa Valley trying to tell us? Seismologist Lucy Jones joins us next on Greater LA. This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Well, it's not the big one. It's a lot of little ones. Folks in the Inland Empire felt a series of small earthquakes last week. And seismologists and residents are trying to figure out what that so-called earthquake swarm could be telling us, or perhaps not telling us. Lucy Jones is a seismologist and the author of The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. And she's with us right now. Hello, Lucy.
Hi.
So this is a flurry of earthquakes. And I say flurry because we're talking about, what, hundreds of them?
It began May 29th, and there have been 857 recorded as of this morning.
And counting.
And counting.
Now, this is the Inland Empire we're talking about near Fontana in Rancho Cucamonga, that area?
It's south of there, Yurupa Valley, but it's in what the seismologists call the Fontana Trend. So there's a trend of small earthquakes that shows up in all of our maps whenever we map the recorded earthquakes, going from Fontana to the southwest into Yurupa Valley.
We said not big ones, but little ones. What are we talking about, little ones?
Tiny ones. Above magnitude 2, there's only been 42 events. So 815 of them are less than magnitude 2.
So that's like closing your oven door or something like that, right?
Pretty much. Even to feel magnitude 2s is surprising. But these earthquakes are shallow, which means that everybody on the surface of the earth is closer to them than if they were at a deeper depth. The only people really feeling these are the people who live directly on top of them.
So let's talk about then what this swarm could or could not be telling us. You're a seismologist. You see a swarm like this, 800 some odd earthquakes. What's the signal here?
We live in earthquake country. It really isn't much different than any other earthquake. The total energy for all of these events is still only the equivalent of something like a magnitude 3.6. And we have those somewhere in California every week, sometimes multiple per week. And so there's very little energy being released in spite of the fact that it's happening in many little events. It really seems to be more just a characteristic of the particular fault. We see swarms like this in the Imperial Valley, up in Owens Valley, the Ventura area, And it really just tells us that that's a characteristic of this region rather than any temporal information. It doesn't tell us something else is coming or not coming either.
So we just don't know, because I remember there was a swarm under the Salton Sea a few years back, and seismologists such as yourself, you were looking at that like, what's going on?
Well, that one's more concerned because it was right next to the San Andreas Fault. So every earthquake has the potential to set off another earthquake. Mostly they're smaller, and we call them aftershocks. If you have a fault capable of a really big earthquake very near where you're having earthquakes, then you have an increased chance that you're going to set off a bigger one, just because you've got a bigger source available to be triggered. I mean, if this swarm were happening right in the Cajon Pass, then we'd have more concern because we have the San Andreas and the Cucamonga and the San Jacinto Fault all sitting there waiting to be triggered.
So that's where the worry is. I know we can't predict earthquakes, but when we see a swarm like that near a major fault like the San Andreas, then we get concerned.
Then we have a higher level of concern.
And it's gotten really warm lately, so this is like earthquake weather, right? I'm trolling you.
Oh, without question. And you know, you give away your age when you talk about that, because it's people for whom the Whittier Narrows earthquake was their first significant earthquake, and it was really hot that day, so they think, oh, that's the earthquake weather. If you're quite a bit older, my mother used to talk about cold, dank, still weather as earthquake weather, because that's what they had for the Long Beach earthquake.
That was the 1930s, right?
Yeah, 1933. Yeah. She was only a few years old, but it was like what got talked about as she was growing up.
Right, and Northridge happened in January, so it probably wasn't particularly hot that day.
It wasn't, though. People will say that there were Santa Anas with it, because a few days later, we did have a Santa Ana condition. In fact, Santa Anas are relatively common in January. They just tend to be cold. And then people say, oh, I remember the Santa Anas with the earthquakes. Well, they're remembering them with the aftershocks, and it actually came after the earthquake. But they still try to make the association. There's a human need to make patterns. What makes earthquakes so frightening is indeed their randomness. So we try to get rid of the randomness. We're trying to find a pattern that'll say, I'm safe at this time as long as this isn't happening. It's wishful thinking.
We know we live in earthquake country. This is just what you expect, and you have to be prepared. What is your biggest worry when it comes to preparing for an earthquake, or even just having one?
My biggest worry is that we will have a really big earthquake during a Santa Ana, not because of earthquake weather, but because all big earthquakes set off fires. And if we have a lot of different triggers of fires with a Santa Ana, we're going to find it very difficult to get those fires under control. That said, that's one of the reasons that we now are really pushing a message of having a fire extinguisher and knowing how to use it. And when an earthquake happens, you should be putting out a fire that you otherwise we'd say, you know, wait, call the fire department. But the fire department's going to be too busy and can't get to you. And you need to be prepared to fight fires after an earthquake that you wouldn't normally do.
So fire extinguisher and your earthquake kit, your survival kit, right?
Right. Well, I don't do a separate kit. The whole kit idea tends to be around hurricanes when you get a prediction and you have to leave. We aren't going to get a prediction. You're going to be in place. I have supplies, but I don't make a point of making sure I can get out with them, because it's much more important to fix up your house so you get to stay there.
Lucy Jones, seismologist, author of The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us. Lucy, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
By the way, in the coming weeks, Dr. Jones and I are going to go do a little fault looking, if you will, across Southern California, and look at the infrastructure, too, to see if it's prepared for a big one or even some little ones. So stay tuned for that on Greater LA. I want to know, how prepared are you for an earthquake? Do you have a kit? Do you have protocol? Have you talked it over with your family, your friends? Tweet me at Radio Chio and hashtag it Greater LA. That is our show for today. Tomorrow, ahead of next year's census, there's a big one coming up in 2020. State and local officials are doing a bunch of outreach, and we're going to take you to the hardest census district to count in all of Southern California. Where do you think that might be? You might be surprised, actually. That's on tomorrow's show. Coming up next on KCRW, it's all the president's lawyers. The U.S. House of Representatives voted to hold Attorney General William Barr and former White House legal counsel Don McGahn in civil contempt. What does that mean? That's coming up. Catherine Barnes Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Reg Warna, Christian Bordahl, they all make this show happen. I'm glad you joined us, too. I'm Steve Giotakis. You can listen to us online, kcrw.com/greaterLA, or check out the podcast, too, wherever you get those podcasts. Thanks for your time. Thanks for your ears today. Let's do it again tomorrow.